the Royal Richmond Hotel. I think with all the past experience and the, you know, being surrounded by various mentors and, you know, different styles of cookery and that sort of thing, it's just, it's a time now to try and pass on all those past learnings to a new group of young people.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. They say what's old is new again. The same can be said for old venues, history in the walls, behind the wallpaper, brought to life again and celebrated with a new light. Just as the gastropubs of Australia have evolved, we have seen money poured into the restoration of old buildings to give them a breath of fresh air. Todd Garrett is a general manager and food and beverage manager of the Royal Richmond Hotel. Todd, how are you?
Yeah, I'm great, Anthony.
You've attached yourself to a building with an incredible history and been part of this redevelopment of it. What's it been like being part of the rebirth of the Royal Richmond?
Yeah, it's been unbelievable. I think it's I've been really fortunate to land in this role and also in a position where I can have an influence of you know, imparting some of my experience and some of my thoughts into the design process and also the build of the Royal at Richmond. I mean, it's one of the oldest pubs in New South Wales. And being in a Macquarie town, there is, you know, a vast amount of history that is attached to the pub and to the area. And I think another Windsor is obviously a Macquarie town, a few others in that area. I think Parramatta is maybe a Macquarie town as well. But when you look back at the history, some of the goings on and just the family ties and the links that still exist today to some of the characters that come into the pub and their stories that are linked to the hotel are really special. So it's been a learning curve, but it's also been exciting to be down in the cellar and coming across, you know, a centuries old refrigeration panel and those sort of things. So it's pretty fun.
is there some stories you can share about the history of the building and the connections to the area?
Yeah, sure. So I'm still learning a little bit about the history, and every time you meet someone, they've got like a different story to share, and obviously a different perspective to impart on the time of the hotel since it's been there since 1848, which is pretty remarkable. And we've spent a lot of time actually, digging up past photos from the building. We have a whole wall that's dedicated in one of the areas of the pub to the timeline of the pub, I guess, from its first days, you know, where the horse troughs out the front and the big steep sort of sandstone gutters and pavements, I guess, the veranda out the front and so on and so forth, to what the pub is to today. And, there's a couple of stories I've heard since I've been there from people, and we actually have a resident that stays at the pub and he's been there for quite a long time as well. So, there's a couple of stories of, you know, some ghosts floating around upstairs. I don't know whether true or not. I've fortunately not bumped into any of them yet. I've heard a story of how there used to be a birthing suite underneath the pub in the cellar. So there's some weird and wacky stories that are attached to the pub, whether they hold any water or there's truth to them. I'm sort of still to find out, but I mean, the bones of the pub itself are amazing. You know, there's still some grand plans that we have for continued renovation of the pub. But as it is at the moment, I think, we've done a fantastic job, and it's really a fantastic representation of, And the credit to the owners, Karen and Peter as well, to their vision and the story they want to tell, which I'm fortunate to be part of.
You've had the most extraordinary career working with some incredible operators and chefs and amazing venues as well. It might be hard to go through all of them, but take us back to when you were young. What sort of role did food play in your family?
Nothing extraordinary. I mean, Mum and Nana were always like pretty active in the kitchen. Nana was actually an amazing cake decorator. Like, she used to do wedding cakes for people, so that I guess there was some sort of spiritual attachment there from an early age. But apart from that, like the sort of the clear memory I have is from being at school and doing one of those, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up type things. And well, first of all, you know, the usual thing was a policeman, because I had an uncle who was a policeman at the time, and I really looked up to him and the shiny, you know, the shiny uniform and all the shiny, you know, buttons on the uniform and so forth, and the polished boots, and sort of loved that and spent a lot of time around that as well. But then, yeah, I sort of always wanted to be a chef. Like I vividly remember drawing a picture of, you know, a knife cutting through a tomato when I was about, you know, 9 or 10 or something. And then made some scones one day with Nana, and, you know, she gave me the big G up and said they were the best scones she ever had. And I don't know where they are to this day, but yeah, I still do enjoy making a scone. But yeah, I fell into it. Like did the old, you know, back in the day, we were still doing what they call it, like a work placement from school at year 10. And I had no real desire to go any further than that. You know, I sort of wasn't particularly enamored with the thought of going on to year 11 and 12. And I, you know, you're familiar with Canberra. I actually did my apprenticeship at a carousel on top of Red Hill, which back in the day was like a classic French old school restaurant where we had Girardon service. We did flambéing, you know, everything cooked to order, all the sauces made to order. So it was, the foundations were, you know, pretty strong from the word go. And I really, you know, was immersed straight away with working with a lot of European chefs. And I mean, a lot of the kitchens in Canberra at that time were run by European chefs, whether they be, you know, Italians or French, or in the case of my original boss, Jean-Pierre, he was French-Swiss, or Swiss-French, I should say. So he always said to me that, hey, you do the right thing by me, you stick with me, I'll make sure that you get set up and we'll send you off overseas, you know, to where I basically learned his craft in Switzerland. And that turned out to be the case. He teed me up with a job in Switzerland, and I arrived in a massive hotel kitchen on my 19th birthday, I think it was, to start in Switzerland. So it was a real eye-opener. And I mean, it was a real gift too, because I was in a position where I could learn another language. And I picked that up pretty quickly, French. And I mean, it's one of those lifelong skills or talents or whatever you want to call it that's stuck with me. And whilst I don't get to use it so often, it's still there. It's still deeply entrenched. And, you know, whenever I pick up a book still or watch a movie, you know, after a few minutes, I get back into the swing of it and away you go. So it's been really fortunate for me, you know, from going from a position where you can, you know, pick up a knife and learn how to turn a potato or make a tomato rose or any of that old school stuff, to, you know, to it just felt right at the time, and it still does. Like it was a great learning curve, and particularly to be exposed, I guess, to those French traditions at an early age was amazing. I remember having a meal actually one of my first days in Switzerland with Jean-Pierre's parents. They picked me up and, you know, went there for a Sunday lunch, you know, on the banks of Lake Geneva, looking over to Mont Blanc, which was spectacular. And we had, like, you know, braised rabbit and you know, all those kind of things you sort of just hear about and read about. And that was just a, you know, a regular Sunday lunch. So I mean, that history and that culture of European cuisine, I guess, is you know, I was super lucky to be exposed from that from a really early point in my career. And particularly, you know, in that hotel restaurant style, you see the traditional, you know, if you're working in garde manger or the larder, you're cutting steaks to order, you're running them over to the section, all those sort of, you know, old hierarchical sort of roles within a hotel kitchen, which put you in good stead for the rest of your career, really.
You worked in Michelin star restaurants in Austria and France. What did you take away from those experiences?
There were some things I always wanted to do. It wasn't until much later. I'd sort of spent a lot of time at Pier. I'd been there for 5 years with your old mate Hodges, which was eye-opening. And Steve and I remain very good friends today. But that was a, you know, fairly seminal time in obviously fish cookery also. And you know, being given the opportunity to work in such an amazing establishment and groundbreaking at the time that Pier was. I was married by then. We started a young family. My former partner is from Austria, And we thought we'd take, you know, like a sabbatical year and go over and work over there. And worked in some time in some Michelin establishments there, some good, some not so good. Particularly the Austrian experience I thought was a standout. I was working in a place called Obertauern, which is in the county of Salzburg, in a two Michelin star place, so run by some brothers who'd been there for many, many years, obviously been in their family for many, many years. And it's just that experience of kind of almost being cooped away. You get up in the morning and you trudge through the snow to get to work. It's still dark. You fire up the stoves. It was very, very modern still. Like this is back in 2000, so it was very progressive food by then. But just to see the way that that training and that almost like military position is applied to everything that's done, whether it's, you know, the receival of goods, the storage, I mean, all those things that are taken for granted in kitchens really of a good caliber. But I mean, it's just a real eye-opener to be exposed full-time to amazing produce that's, you know, coming directly from farms, or, you know, you could, like a cellar out the back that's just uniquely there for the storage and ripening of cheese and all those amazing, you know, wonderful things that you get to experience in Michelin-starred environments, I think. And then I guess one of the other massive eye-openers for my time there was I got the chance to work in a pastry shop in my former partner's hometown of Hallein in County Salzburg as well. And that pastry shop had been there since like 1740 or something in the family. You know, and originally they only just used honey and, you know, there's no kind of sugar at the time, essentially. So their trade was in candles and gingerbread, you know, and Hare Brown, who was the patriarch of the family, who was passing on his trade and his knowledge to his twin sons, had trained under Gaston Lenotre. So there was this, you know, again, this amazing sort of thoroughbred, I guess you could call it, lineage of pastry chefdom, which I was being exposed to, which was super cool to see as well. And just those traditions and all the sort of things that we don't take for granted in Australia that you get to be exposed to in Europe. So I'm, you know, I love that whole part of my career.
You mentioned Pierre, and you spent 5 years as head chef there, one of the most influential restaurants in Australia's history, with incredible alumni that have done all sorts of things. And you mentioned Steve Hodges. Take us back to that time. What was it like for you in that role?
It was a very steep learning curve. You know, Greg and Steve were very rigorous in what they wanted to do and the story they wanted to tell. And I guess when you compare to, you know, take for example, what Josh is doing now at Fish Butchery and St. Peter and Charcoal Fish, like, you know, his what he's doing now is version God knows what. It's you know, really, you know, breathtaking what he's doing and groundbreaking and boundary pushing. Sort of where we were at is, I guess, version one, where we, you know, started to dry scale fish and you know, treat fish in a very different manner, like keep them away from water and all those sort of things that Josh preaches about now, which when you see them, you know, many years down the track, you realize that, you know, we're really onto something back then. And I mean, you know, it's through the networks that were created back then too, you know, with John Sussman, with Flying Squid, all those guys, you know, obviously know John very well. You know, they've done so much, particularly for the seafood industry, and bringing greater recognition and greater importance to our seafood stocks. I mean, even back then, you know, some of the products we saw back in the day, and I'm talking this is back in like 19, this must have been like 90, 91 or 92, like some of that product you just don't see anymore, you know, unfortunately, because it's been, you know, the resources have been poorly managed or you know, the stocks are dwindling, whatever. Look, there's been a massive change, but you know, things obviously the ship's being righted a lot now. But that you know, that focus of just treating fish simply with as little touch as possible, and you know, there were many, many times we would have frustrating days, you know, trying to educate the dining public on how fish, or the perception of how we perceive fish should be cooked. I.e. just cooking to a point where it's just cooked, almost verging on, you know, just set. So there was some, you know, some interesting services, to say the least, with Mr. Hodges and co.
You spent time with Neil Perry and Andy Evans at Spice Temple as well. How different was that compared to the kitchens you had been in?
Yeah, that was kind of like a brief sort of almost a segue. I'd finished up our time in the restaurants I'd previously owned with Tracy Trinder and James Heard. We'd been in business together for about 12 or so years across a various number of establishments. And I was, again, I'd sort of just looking for a bit of a breath of fresh air or you know, taking time out to reassess and take stock of, you know, what was going to be the next stage of my life and where I was going to go from there, I guess. And, I'd known Andy for quite a few years by then. We used to play some late night ping pong across the road from Buzo, which we owned, at the Light Brigade Hotel. He was chef at the Light Brigade at the time. So we used to spend a fair bit of time hanging out after work, drinking beer and playing lock-in ping pong, which was good fun. And so we'd always remained in contact, and I just sort of fell into a part-time role at Spice Temple. I'd never really had the opportunity to cook Asian food before, and particularly with all the various styles of Chinese that I believe they master at Spice Temple. Like Andy's an amazing chef and has an amazing affinity with the ingredients they use at Spice Temple, and obviously they're using the best that they can get. You know, the beautiful fish from Corner Inlet, or you know, everything that Neil has championed for so many years. That was a great experience, and just being able to sort of finally understand and apply some of those techniques in a more Western way as well, and just get an understanding of how things are treated in an Eastern kitchen, I guess. But I wasn't there for that long, probably about 9 months or so. But I really enjoyed the time there down in the depths below Bridge Street there.
That 12-year period that you spoke of just before, where you owned and ran, you know, some of the most awarded restaurants and celebrated restaurants of that era, you know, whether it was Buzo or the Wine Library or Vincent. Tell us about that period of time. What was it like being caught up in that energy and the creation of those venues?
Yeah, so we sort of fell into Buzo a little bit. We inherited that restaurant and brand from the former owners, Daryl Taylor and Rob Broadbent, and we sort of just continued. You know, we saw the sort of value in the brand, and obviously the value and what had been begun with Buzo, and we just pushed it a bit further and made it our own. And it was just really just our interpretation of what we thought, you know, Italian trattoria style food could be in an Australian environment, and people did love it, and it was one of those establishments that you could frequent a couple of times a week because it wasn't particularly challenging. It was just, you know, good times, tasty food, you know, much the same as like I go to Bar Vincent now, literally just around the corner from my place. It has a very similar vibe. I think it's one of those places that like the quality and the execution of the food is second to none, and Andy and Sarah and the team do an amazing job, and it's one of those places that you feel welcome and you want to go back to over and over and again. And I think that's what we had at Buzo, and by extension Wine Library and Vincent. You know, they're really cool times, but that's you know, like everything in hospitality, I think there's a shelf life to everything you do, and you know, the shelf life had sort of, or the run had come to its time, and it was time to move on to other things. And I mean, that's where I'm now, many years on from that. Like at the Royal Richmond Hotel, I think with all the past experience and the, you know, being surrounded by various mentors and, you know, different styles of cookery and that sort of thing, it's just it's a time now to try and pass on all those past learnings to a new group of young people that we're trying to, you know, foster at the Royal. We really want it to become the, you know, the premium or the number one hospitality venue of choice. You know, if you want to go learn about hospitality, you know, come to the Royal now, because that's, you know, we've got a wealth of experience between myself, Karen, with whom I worked at Pier many years ago, and she worked, she worked across many of Sydney's finer establishments as well, and Peter Wynn, who's been a lifelong publican. So, you know, I've landed in an environment of, you know, great strength and understanding and passion for food and wine and hospitality.
Tell us a bit about what you've created there and what the offering will be. You've got such a rich history from a culinary perspective and also very different venues, but what are we going to see at the Richmond Royal?
Yeah, so it's like, I guess we're not, it's never going to be sort of like a cookie cutter menu too much in a sense. Like, I mean, a pub always needs to have, in some respects, certain dishes and certain offerings that make people come from, make, you know, they know they're in a pub. You know, I'm talking schnitzels and obviously really good quality house steak. You know, we have a pizza offering and all that sort of thing. But I guess the underlying story we're trying to tell is the engagement. I know it's a word that's bandied around ever so often, but that sort of farm to table. You know, you sourcing the products locally and then using them as much as we can, which is not always that easy in a high volume pub environment, in the pub kitchen. But we're blessed in the fact that we're in this amazing food bowl, and I think a lot of chefs in Sydney just don't quite understand how close to Sydney a lot of the produce is coming. You know, we've got farmers in the road, Block 11 down the road, that I made the association when I was working with Josh and helping out doing the carriage work markets. Greg from Block 11 was always at the markets and always have a chat, and then it wasn't until later that we realised he was literally down the end of the street at the pub. So we use Greg quite frequently. You know, we get these beautiful prawns from Gary Howard over at over on the banks of the Hawkesbury. And I mean, having Marty Boats out there as well has been really helpful. He's made many introductions to local farmers as well. And we see the the generations of families have been coming to the pub as well. Like, there's lots of, you know, Maltese farmers have been working the land there forever, you know, who grow vegetables and salads and all those sort of things. And it's, you know, we've got neighbours down the road who've got an amazing orchard and, you know, 100-year-old pecan trees. We've got about 120 kilos of pecans sitting in bins at the moment that we're slowly working our way through, that, you know, we incorporate to the menu. And you know, we just did a massive bake sale on the weekend for the launch of our new bar in the beer garden. So there's a stack of new projects we're working on, we've launched, and we still have to do. And I guess one of the most exciting programs we've introduced there is the meat program. We offer different cuts, you know, different primal cuts, in consultation with Darren O'Rourke from Vicks, who's been really helpful. And he's a Kurrajong resident, so that's very handy as well, because he'll stop in for a beer and have a chat on his way home from work. And also from the WSU, the Western Sydney University, we work very closely with Joe Kovacek, who runs the farm management program there. So he's been breeding all manner of cow, like Black Angus, you know, Limousin. He's got beautiful black-faced Suffolk lambs out there as well. So we sort of tap into that market, and we have them processed over at Wilberforce. And then Darren helps us out with the you know, breaking the majority of the animal down to the primals for us at Vicks. And we take back all the primals and we use as much as we can, you know, whether it's by way of doing producers' dinners or offering those in the bistro itself. So we've got a massive bandsaw and dry aging cabinets. So we cut the primals to order and grill them over lava rock. And it's pretty cool. Like, I had my doubts when we first sort of conceived, you know, it's not like it's never been done before, but I mean, in a pub environment on the outskirts of Sydney, and which is predominantly a semi rural environment, I sort of had my doubts to begin with, but people love it, and they line up for it. That's a bit of theatre as well, you know, diving into the dry aging cabinets in the midst of a, you know, 250 or 300 cover service, and lopping off steaks, perilously trying to avoid your fingers, and, you know, sort of giving the spiel. But it's, yeah, I mean, it just gives a different element to what we're trying to do, and a little bit of a story. And the majority of the people who live in the Hawkesbury as well understand that attachment and welcome it as well. You know, we're looking at getting our own, you know, we source honey down the road from Signature Honey. Sky, a young girl, has been has got some hives down on some of the polo land there, and that's we've forged a bit of a relationship with her, and yeah, there's some really exciting stuff going on. But just that ability of being able to say, okay, well, when I'm driving to work and I'm coming along Richmond Road, on the left hand side, I'm seeing the cows that could eventually or will eventually end up on the plate in the pub, and it's literally, you know, a kilometre or two away. So I mean that's really exciting, and I mean Joe takes so much care and thought to the, you know, with the breeding program, and also how much time he puts into maintaining and managing the pasture so that, you know, the cows are have this amazing grass fed diet for the majority of their time, and yeah, it's really cool.
What do you think makes a great gastropub?
I think it just comes down to the hospitality, really. I think I wouldn't really call what we're doing like gastropub. You know, there's still a strong focus on being just your everyday pub, but there is also, you know, I guess with the meat program and a couple of other things that we do, there is a lot more craft involved, I guess. Like, you know, we are making puff pastry, we're making pies out of pastry that's being made instead of just going to the freezer and dropping a shatter pack onto the ground and, you know, hoping it yields something that's edible. So we're really instilling we're trying to instill a craft into everything the guys do, you know, that comes down to in the future we want to have a bakery on site, well, not necessarily on at the pub, but very close by, so that we can, you know, sort of continue that and sort of leave some sort of legacy for the young guys who are starting to come on board and they've embraced that. And I think, people who live in the area, and, you know, you have to, like, Richmond is still a little bit of an island in some respect. It's still 30 minutes from Penrith. It's still, you know, it's kind of its own little town. It's got its own little vibe going on. So in some respects, yeah, people are seeing the pub as a little bit more of a night out now, which is really encouraging. And then, you know, we take that time, you know, we're making our own sausages. It's just, I think, you know, the gastropub thing is just about wanting to instill some craft into everything that you do and making it as homemade, I guess, as possible. And that comes down to like all the preserves we do and the pickles and all those little bits we do that we can offer in a retail setting as well, at the bistro counter. Everything that kind of makes it a fun place to work. I think, you know, from a chef's perspective, I think if you're going to go to the Royal and work now, at least you're going to, you know, pick up some skills that you may not have otherwise. And I'm very fortunate to have Joe Ward from Bistro Rex, and like formerly of Claude's, and, you know, who spent many, many years working with Chong Lu as well. So she's an amazing craftsperson. She's a very good friend of mine as well, but we're extraordinarily lucky that she can afford us like 3 or 4 days a week. And she's really taken on that mentoring role in the kitchen, which the young'uns are appreciating.
The last 2 years have had an incredible impact on everyone on the planet and those in the hospitality sector. What sort of impact has sinking your teeth into this project had on you during this time?
Yeah, well, it's been very stop-start. Like, originally I was really involved in the project to set up the kitchen and design the kitchen, and one thing turned to another, and, the conversations evolved and ended up becoming the general manager, which is a novelty, and also the opportunity to learn something of a new set of skills. I mean, I've run businesses before, but this is, you know, same sort of skill set in a very different environment. There's definitely some trepidation to begin with. Like, you know, everyone knows it in pubs, a little bit what goes on. Like, if there's a bit of, a bit of loose banter or, you know, some elbows that go the wrong way, everyone knows what can happen. So from that perspective, yeah, there's a lot to learn. But, for the majority of, you know, the people are very well behaved. I was a little bit concerned when I first started there. Like, I'm not the biggest guy. I'd never be able to, jump into a ring with anyone, nor would I want to, nor is that my role either. But, I mean, there's some big individuals out there that can be a little bit intimidating sometimes. But it has been stop start. Like, obviously in that area there's, you know, been COVID, We're really lucky in the sense that we retained a lot of the staff, even up post this last, you know, this other lengthy lockdown. We only lost about one or two staff members out of about 40, which was incredible. Which means I think that the staff are really buying into what we're trying to do, and they're part of, you know, they want to be part of the story and part of the growth. And they, you know, for the guys who are looking to make a career in hospitality, they're sinking their teeth in, which is awesome to see. But you know, in amongst that, we've had the floods. You know, had the big floods back in when was that? In probably April, I think, or around that time. You know, and then the fires, you know, prior to the pandemic as well. So it's a very resilient community out in Richmond. You know, everyone sort of jumps in and helps each other. And, you know, we've tried to do our best by supporting like a lot of the local organisations, the RFS, you know, particularly with the Freeman's Reach RFS. We have a really good association with them now, and we, you know, we organise events to help raise money for them. And, it, you know, it's all about, you know, that's, I think, one of the major roles of a pub is, you know, that real community engagement. You know, we're fortunate enough to be in a position that we can host events and, you know, push forward certain stories that we think are valid and worthwhile and worthy for the community. So, I mean, that's the majority of the work that I do now is sort of that community engagement and, you know, creating events and other sort of activities where we can, you know, like foster relationships and get that return clientele coming back.
You've had an extraordinary career, and there's venues that we just haven't even had a chance to even mention during this conversation that you've been part of. But what is it that you love about what you do?
Oh, I think it's just the diversity of the role. I mean, I don't think I've ever really worked as, like, I mean, I've always been a hard worker. I've never been shy of doing the hours or, you know, putting in the time. But this role is really something that is, you know, an all-encompassing role, like, you know, from sorting out DJs to, you know, keeping an eye on the food and beverage, what's going on there, to, you know, working on the wine program and the cocktails and training and project managing renovations, all that sort of stuff. Like I just love being engaged, like all the senses being engaged and having my fingers in many pies at once. So, you know, whilst you definitely make mistakes and errors are made, it's, you know, you're learning all the time. And I mean, at you know, for the time I've been in the industry, that's the thing that excites me the most, is that the continual learning process and the ability to keep on learning. I mean, I haven't lost my passion to cook or to be involved in the kitchen, so I'm really fortunate from that respect as well to be able to, like, you know, dip my toes in there every week and, you know, help out with the Sunday roast and all those things, you know, all those little bits and bobs, and, like, you know, hey, I want to do this on the menu this week, can we try doing this, and, you know, just get me the ingredients together and, you know, we can make some pastry or we can make some donuts or whatever it is, you know, but it's at least it you know, it engages everyone, the whole kitchen get involved, and it keeps me sort of in touch with that side of things. And yeah, I think it's a role that, you know, you could do this role in the city, but it would probably be more just purely admin, I think. Whereas this, it's you know, it's very hands on, so to speak. Still, you know, from the hospitality perspective of, you know, engaging the guests and, you know, going around and having a chat with them every day and, you know, shooting the shit, so to speak, to, you know, the finer points of, you know, working out contracts to do with beverages and all that sort of stuff. So it's a really cool job. I love it.
Well, the redevelopment and what you've created there in one of Australia's, you know, most important pubs in a historical sense is pretty extraordinary. And I look forward to seeing what you do over the next year with it. We've loved having you on Deep in the Weeds today to hear a bit of your story.
Tom. Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Please keep in touch, and we'll catch up again soon.
Will do. Cheers, Anthony.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector.
Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen.
Follow us on Instagram @DeepInTheWeeds Podcast.
or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.